Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
To listen to Killer Psyche ad-free right now, join Wondery Plus by starting your free trial in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. It was a very cold Sunday afternoon in Manhattan on the first weekend of 2015. Wall Street hedge fund founder Thomas Gilbert dropped off his laundry at the dry cleaners and wished them a very happy new year. That morning, Tom had played doubles tennis near the Upper East Side apartment he shared with his wife, Shelley. At a quarter past three, Tom was relaxing in the bedroom, watching Sunday football, when the doorbell rang. This was unusual, because their doorman had not buzzed them to announce a visitor. But when Shelley answered the door and saw their son, 30-year-old Thomas Gilbert Jr., or Tommy, as he was known, she was pleasantly surprised and ushered him in. The relationship between father and son was strained. Shelley hoped the visit might be a good sign. Tommy told his mother he needed to talk to his father, quote, about business, and said it was important. Tommy asked her to go out and get him a sandwich and a Coke. She offered to make him a sandwich herself, but Tommy specifically wanted a Coke. Shelley never kept Cokes in their home. So she agreed. As she was leaving, Tommy suggested she stay out for a while so he could have one-on-one time with his father. This made Shelley uneasy. Earlier that day, Tom Sr. had logged into a shared Citibank account and significantly lowered his son's weekly allowance. Shelley walked around the block and quickly returned without the food and drink. She did not go in right away, but paced in the hallway outside the apartment. She tried listening through the door, but heard nothing. She opened the door. There was no sign of Tommy Jr., but Thomas Gilbert Sr. was lying on the ground beside their bed in a pool of blood. And resting on his chest was a handgun. As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is the second season of Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. I've interviewed lots of murderers, including serial killers. And the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. It is difficult to get a satisfying answer without diving deep into their mindsets. So that's what we're doing. And I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is Thomas Gilbert Jr., the Golden Boy Killer. On Sunday, January 4th, 2015, Thomas Gilbert Jr. took a .40 caliber Glock from the safe in his New York City apartment, put on a hoodie, and walked to the subway to make the short trip uptown to his parents' place. For years, his parents supported him financially, including paying the $2,400 monthly rent on his apartment. Family tensions had escalated in recent months as Tom Sr.'s own fortunes took a hit. His hedge fund, Wainscott Capital Partners, was struggling, which left the elder Gilberts worried about money. By the time Shelley allowed Tommy inside their apartment that fateful day, he had not held a steady job in years. After his mother left the house, Tommy was alone with his father. He pressed the muzzle of the gun so tightly against the older man's head that an imprint was visible on his temple. In my line of work, that is called a contact wound. The gun actually contacted the skin. Tommy fired one bullet in his father's brain. He tried another round, but the gun jammed. Tommy then placed the gun on his father's chest in an attempt to make the death look like a suicide. I have to tell you, I've never seen a suicide victim where the gun was balanced perfectly on their chest. Then he slipped out of the apartment and went back to his place downtown. Hours later, around 4 p.m., Tommy called his mother on her cell phone. She was with detectives who told her to answer the call and try to act as normal as possible. So she did. Tommy suggested they meet for lunch, said he would get back to her with a place. Then he hung up. Shelley gave detectives her son's address. Within the next hour, a detective knocked on his door, but no one answered. Tommy was inside, busy wiping his electronic devices clean. He disabled the Find My Phone app. He also called a defense attorney his father and uncle had hired for him the year prior after he assaulted his roommate. And finally, Tommy Googled himself in order to see what, if anything, people were saying about his father's death. At that moment, the SWAT team arrived. Although Tommy refused at first to exit his apartment, he eventually unlocked the door. He then followed the officer's instructions to lay face down while they cuffed and arrested him. Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital. On sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Thomas Gilbert Jr. was born on July 13, 1984. He was the firstborn child of Shelley and Thomas Gilbert Sr., two up-and-coming young Wall Street professionals. His father, Tom, was a lifelong New Yorker whose family money came from the textile industry. He was educated at Princeton and earned an MBA from Harvard. When he met Shelley, Tom was on his way to becoming managing director at a renowned investment banking firm. But Shelley's star was rising too. She was already a vice president at another Wall Street power firm, and her family roots went back to a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Shelley grew up in New Jersey, attended a private girls' school, and was a debutante. But 6 months after her debut, tragedy struck Shelley's family. Her father, who was diagnosed as bipolar, killed himself by jumping out of the fifth-story window of a psychiatric hospital. Shelley and her mother were shattered. Looking for a fresh start, they moved across the river to Manhattan. Their new home was an exclusive co-op apartment building called River House. Shelley and Tom Gilbert married the year after they met. And in 1985, a year after Tommy was born, she quit her high-powered job to become a stay-at-home mother. The Gilberts settled into a spacious apartment on the Upper East Side, close to the school where Tom Sr. had studied and where Tommy was also accepted. Tommy soon became a big brother to baby sister Bess. He seemed to fit in well at school. He was described as quiet, but with a sense of humor. He dreamed of becoming an astronaut, and his dad arranged for him to attend NASA's iconic space camp. The Gilberts were moving into more exclusive social circles by the early 1990s. They moved into a Park Avenue apartment and bought a summer home in the Hamptons. Tommy was a gifted athlete who spent summers surfing and playing tennis. He also loved and excelled at swimming, and eventually became a lifeguard. Back in the city, Tommy was captain of the school football team. His grades were strong, consistently earning A's, and he was elected to the student council. One of his former classmates remembers him as a golden boy. But he was showing signs of anxiety and paranoia and started using alcohol and marijuana. He had dreams where he was either attacking his father or his father was attacking him. This was not a one-time thing. These were recurring dreams. According to the book Golden Boy, A Murder Among the Manhattan Elite by John Glatt, Tommy told a psychiatrist that he recalled sitting on a bus next to a friend when he was in the sixth grade. He told the doctor he, quote, immediately lost social skills and said he did not feel like himself. Tommy also reported that he was convinced that he caught depression from a childhood friend, like someone would catch a cold from someone else. During high school, Tommy's relationship with his father also started to fray. He felt his father was pressuring him to play more tennis and take particular courses at school, and Tommy didn't like it. He resisted. His father had a tough love approach to his parenting style, and that frequently upset Tommy. For example, once Tom Sr. called the school principal to report a rumor that Tommy and his friends smoked marijuana during the father-son camping trip. When Tommy found out, he became enraged. I can imagine all of Tommy's friends at school were very upset with him. Like many boys from Manhattan, Tommy went off to an elite private boarding school. In 2000, he started his sophomore year at Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts. The new school seemed like a good fit. Tommy did well academically, even studying Mandarin and making the honor roll. And he competed on 4 sports teams as well as the debate team. That's rather impressive, to say the least. His advisor recalls Tommy was quiet but very popular, and that his good looks drew a lot of attention from the female students, who he said would practically throw themselves at him. I've seen his picture, and he looked like a young Brad Pitt. But during his junior year, Tommy began to struggle. He became convinced that his roommate was, quote, contaminated. It seems to me that a serious mental illness, a thought disorder, was emerging, which, if the person has that problem, the disorder will rear its ugly head in late adolescence to early adulthood. When Tommy turned 17, the summer of 2001, his parents noticed he was constantly washing his hands, and he was losing his clothes because he said they were contaminated. This makes me wonder, was obsessive compulsive disorder emerging as well? It is true, an individual can have more than one psychiatric disorder. His friends also noticed changes in how Tommy spoke. He was making long, drawn-out ahs, followed by a stream of strung-together words, then back to the ahs. They noticed it was often hard for him to finish a sentence, but his parents believed it would pass. This could be a sign of a thought disorder. Back at school, For his senior year, Tommy took rigorous classes and continued competing on the varsity teams while following his father's wish that he apply to Princeton, like so many of the other men in his family, including his dad, uncle, and grandfather. In his college application, Tommy admitted to suffering from depression. He wrote, quote, "I am glad to have come out of this period with a set of beliefs and standards by which I can always act." But Tommy's symptoms were getting worse. He still believed certain people were contaminated and that some of his friends were, quote, "trying to steal his soul." That is a delusion. And what is a delusion? It is an unwavering belief in a concept or idea that has no basis in fact, and the individual believes it despite having no evidence to support it. According to the book Golden Boy, in order to cope, Tommy developed a set of rituals he believed could offer himself protection, including giving someone the finger from inside his pocket, or turning his head away and spitting, or humming tunes under his breath. Despite his efforts to control his thoughts, by the time Tommy graduated high school in 2003, he was still battling these demons. Of course, these are very serious psychiatric symptoms that do not go away with time or tricks. When Tommy got into Princeton, his wealthy uncle agreed to pay his entire tuition. Move-in day did not go smoothly. Tommy asked his father not to come, saying he wanted to be alone with his mother. But his father refused and went with them anyway. On the way there, Tommy said his father, quote, "made me pull over for gas near JFK, which at the time was severely contaminated and led to all my new clothes being contaminated." It's difficult for me to understand why his parents overlooked these incredibly disturbing behaviors and didn't seek him professional help. Clearly, regarding the contamination, Tommy's delusions centered around germs and getting dirty. His symptoms worsened at Princeton. No surprise, he was in a new situation, and his support system wasn't there. That would be stressful for any kid, let alone one who was becoming seriously mentally ill. He believed his old boarding school roommate was somewhere on campus contaminating his things, even though the former roommate was not there. At this point, it seems to me, there is a paranoid flavor to his delusions. And that is the most dangerous form of schizophrenia. Paranoid schizophrenia. Think about it. What would you do if you truly believed other people were out to hurt you? Tommy returned to his coping rituals, but he changed them up a bit. He began picking different outfits for different areas of campus. This meant he had to constantly be changing his clothes and throwing out many of his clothes entirely. But there were other issues. Tommy started taking steroids after he made the Princeton football team. He also added cocaine and LSD into his drug cocktail. The absolute worst drug that someone with a thought disorder can take is an hallucinogen like LSD. He was put on academic probation for drug possession. And if that's not enough, he was caught with computer hacking software. Tom Sr. was upset by Tommy's suspension and finally reached out to a psychiatrist for advice. But it was a child psychiatrist. Tommy, at this point, was an adult. The doctor met with both parents and noted how Shelley was insisting there was nothing wrong with Tommy. Perhaps she was afraid to admit that her son's mental problems stemmed from her familial line. Remember, her father was bipolar and killed himself. During his time away from college, Tommy went to South Carolina to surf. The extended trip was paid for by his parents. This was a turning point. 20-year-old Tommy, in October 2004, had his first meeting ever with a psychiatrist. He told the doctor people were contaminating him and stealing his personality. The psychiatrist diagnosed Tommy with depressive disorder and possible psychosis, and at the next session, put him on Risperdal, an antipsychotic medication. He also called Tommy's parents and recommended hospitalization. Instead, Tommy stayed in South Carolina to surf, but he did continue to see the psychiatrist. During this time, Tommy suffered two panic attacks, so the doctor recommended increasing his Risperdal dosage. Tommy declined, complaining about the side effects such as male breast growth. The doctor also adjusted Tommy's diagnosis to include possible schizophrenia and prescribed him Zoloft and an additional antipsychotic medication. Despite medication and psychiatric treatment, Tommy's mental health was deteriorating. In 2005, he was still in South Carolina when he told his doctor he wanted to buy a gun and called 911 stating he was suicidal. Tommy was taken to a local emergency room but refused treatment and left. But soon after this incident, Tommy mentioned he had not slept in 4 days, which prompted his doctor to admit him to a local hospital. But Tommy left after one night, stating he was bothered by the other patient in his room. Sleep deprivation in and of itself can cause an otherwise healthy person to become psychotic and to hallucinate. So you can imagine how that would make Tommy's mental state even worse than it already was. When I worked on a psychiatric unit, we would sedate patients with Tommy's diagnosis so they could get the sleep they desperately needed. The doctor urged Tommy to have inpatient treatment at a psychiatric hospital in Massachusetts. And though his parents were on board with it, and Tommy verbally agreed, he never went. This doesn't surprise me. Tommy was paranoid. He probably was suspicious of anything his parents wanted him to do. But at this point, he should have been involuntarily admitted. But that didn't happen. Instead, he went on an around-the-world surfing vacation, funded by his parents. Finally, over 2 years after his suspension from Princeton, 22-year-old Tommy returned to campus in the fall of 2006. There, he began seeing another psychiatrist who diagnosed him with attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, obsessive-compulsive disorder, also known as OCD, Tourette syndrome, and possible Lyme disease. And he put Tommy on the drugs Lexapro, an antidepressant, Klonopin, a benzodiazepine that has a tranquilizing effect and can be addictive, and, once again, the antipsychotic medication Risperdal. Sadly, it is typical for one psychiatrist to discount the diagnosis and treatment plan of a previous doctor. In the end, the patient suffers, and sometimes society suffers. He also started taking steroids again, which eventually got him kicked off the football team. Steroids in and of themselves can also cause psychosis, but when they are tapered off, the patient usually recovers their normal mental state. But not in this case. So the steroids were in no way the cause of Tommy's ongoing and chronic thought disorder. He started having the thought disorder before the steroid use. As if Tommy weren't on enough drugs, he also took recreational drugs at campus parties. Perfect. People with severe mental problems will take anything that will even momentarily alleviate their suffering. In the spring of 2007, Tommy was suffering from delusions severely and went on a days-long bender that landed him in the emergency room. He told 911 operator he was overdosing on cocaine. He was met by police at the hospital, who arrested him for drug possession. He was restrained for being uncooperative, but he still managed to headbutt one of the nurses. Because of that, police added on a charge of aggravated assault. But Tommy didn't go to jail. He was put on supervised probation, and the charges were later dropped after he completed the program. Once again, he should have been committed to a psychiatric facility and properly diagnosed and treated. But once again, that didn't happen. Tommy took a bartending course a few months after his arrest. But on the night of the exam, he left and told a psychiatrist he was paranoid of the customers at the bar. Whoever told Tommy bartending would be a good profession for him was off their rocker. Oddly enough, Tommy was dating, and he was dating the niece of comedian Chevy Chase. The two of them seemed happy, and they even moved in together at her parents' house. Tommy's parents were also seemingly happy about the couple. That doesn't surprise me. They probably thought being involved with the young lady would cure his problems. I find it incredible that neither Chase's niece or her parents noticed anything was wrong, because Tommy was far from well. He told his doctor that Saturday Night Live, the TV show, was directly, quote, making fun of him. That is a psychiatric symptom known as ideas of reference. He thought the same about certain New York Times articles and various blogs. Ideas of reference means that the individual believes everything he hears and sees is referring to him. Tommy actually pondered hiring a lawyer to sue Saturday Night Live's network. But first, he asked his girlfriend, whose uncle was an original cast member, what she thought. She talked him out of it. Tommy opened up to her about his symptoms. She encouraged him to see a new psychiatrist who diagnosed him with, quote, severe compulsive depressive paranoid and delusional disorders. And that doctor prescribed some of the same medicine as the last but added a mood stabilizer. Tommy tried them, but apparently did not stay on the medications. He told the doctor one of the side effects was affecting his sexual performance. His delusions continued. He told the doctor he believed his father was trying to, quote, steal his soul, and claimed he could see his father's face when he looked in mirrors. He also thought other people were trying to steal his soul using magnets. In the year leading up to his father's murder, Tommy's parents paid for him to begin seeing, guess what? A new psychiatrist. That guy diagnosed Tommy with OCD, like the others had, but also added bipolar disorder, delusional disorder, and schizophrenia. Tommy Gilbert was a cornucopia of severe mental illnesses. The doctor noted that even though schizophrenia was a grave diagnosis, it would not interfere with his ability to work and maintain social relationships. It is true, many people with schizophrenia can hold jobs, but medication compliance is essential. Also, like any other illness, there is a spectrum of intensities. And on a scale of 1 to 10, Tommy was a 9. Considering Tommy's extremely poor history with medication compliance, that doctor's prognosis was highly unlikely. All signs pointed to Tommy getting worse, not better. Unfortunately, Tommy's behavior was turning violent. The summer before he murdered his father, Tommy threatened two former classmates at a Hamptons bar. He lunged at them and threatened to kill them. He kneed his former roommate in the face and broke his nose. He did this outside the Brooklyn apartment they once shared. After Tommy attacked him, the former roommate pressed charges. Tom Sr. wondered in a computer diary whether Tommy, quote, should use an insanity defense. Oh, now you're accepting that your son might be insane? For help, he turned to Tommy's uncle, the one who paid his Princeton tuition, who replied, quote, this is an outgrowth of his personality. He is milking us, and then something worse will happen in the future. His uncle was right about one thing. Something worse was going to happen. But Tommy wasn't milking them. Tommy, at this point, was incapable of taking care of himself. People that think and behave like Tommy, due to schizophrenia, cannot hold a job. They found a defense lawyer for Tommy, and the assault charge was dismissed after Tommy agreed to go to anger management. When Tommy's psychiatrist heard about the attack on the roommate, he was very concerned, and rightfully so. Tommy had previously mentioned his interest in guns and suicide. But at the time, the doctor did not think it warranted reporting to the authorities. However, this new information changed his mind. According to the New York SAFE Act, the law bans mentally ill people and criminals from buying guns. And the doctor reported Tommy as a danger to himself and society. Tommy later approached the former roommate at a gathering one night to bury the hatchet. But instead, the former roommate called Tommy's father and urged him to have his son institutionalized. But that did not happen. In the early morning hours of September 15, 2004, Tommy allegedly set fire to the former roommate's historic Hamptons home. then watched the blaze from a cemetery across the street. The former roommate told detectives he was certain Tommy was responsible for the fire, and Tommy was questioned. He was eventually charged with violating a restraining order that his former roommate had on him, but then he was released for lack of evidence. So do I agree with Tommy's latest psychiatrist that he is a paranoid schizophrenic? His extreme paranoia, along with his delusions, like the Saturday Night Live incident and New York Times articles making fun of him, those are very profound symptoms that say yes. Those are indications that he has a serious thought disorder, and that means he's suffering from schizophrenia. And there are subtypes. Remember, there's more than one type of schizophrenia. His is paranoid, and it is the most dangerous form of this thought disorder. As we explored in the Richard Chase vampire killer episode from last season, people with this kind of schizophrenia experience such intense paranoia that they see persecution of them everywhere. They feel that everyone is out to get them, hurt them, or even kill them. Just like Tommy thought that people were trying to steal his soul, or trying to do so by using magnets, or that people were contaminating him. But there were other behaviors before his first diagnosis that were concerning. For example, the disorganized speech patterns that his friends noticed, where he struggled to complete sentences or interjected the long "ahs" as if he was searching for a word. And then when he completed the sentence, it was gibberish. That is a symptom of schizophrenia the Mayo Clinic calls disorganized thinking speech. Quote, effective communication can be impaired, and answers to questions may be partially or completely unrelated. For example, the question, isn't it a beautiful day today? And the answer, I think the pig is hungry. They don't go together. That's disorganized thinking that results in disorganized speech. Rarely, speech may include putting together meaningless words that can't be understood, sometimes known as word salad. We have no indication that Tommy was hearing voices, also known as auditory hallucinations, and that typically goes along with schizophrenia, especially the paranoid subtype. However, Tommy also meets the criteria for schizoaffective disorder, and that means the patient has delusional thinking, such as Tommy did, along with another or several mood disorders, such as depression. And we know that he suffered from that. He even talked about it on his application to Princeton. We know that Tommy's maternal grandfather, who died by suicide, was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And since genetics is one possible contributing factor, I think this adds to the likelihood that Tommy suffered from it as well. Bipolar disorder often comes with persecutory delusions. The fact that Tommy seemed to experience highs and lows, academic and athletic success, and then days-long benders on drugs and alcohol and sleepless nights points to bipolar 1. I agree with the diagnosis that Tommy had obsessive-compulsive disorder, but trust me when I tell you, that was the least of his problems. He spent that fall surfing in the Bahamas and looking into introductory firearms courses. He also visited a site called hireakiller.com and made online searches using phrases like murder for hire and hitman forum. At the end of October, Tommy's psychiatrist said he would no longer treat him unless he started taking medication. Tommy never responded. His family continued to support him financially, but their patience was waning. In November, Tommy's father dropped his allowance from $600 to $500 a week, and then to $400 a week in December. On the morning of his murder, Tom Sr. reduced Tommy's allowance to $300 a week. I'm guessing that his parents thought if they reduced his external income, he would take it upon himself to earn money. Boy, were they wrong. That same morning, Tommy got an email from the Hamptons Tennis Club saying his credit card had been declined. Then he got an email from the realtor he had hired without his parents' knowledge, wanting to confirm the $11.5 million listing price on his parents' home in the Hamptons. But Tommy was making plans even before he knew of his father's last humiliating allowance cutback. Tommy saw an ad for a used handgun on Facebook. He bought the gun for $575. The seller informed Tommy it would be illegal to ship the gun directly. But that didn't bother him at all. Tommy simply drove to the seller, who was in Ohio. The seller would later describe Tommy as, quote, like a kid with a new gun.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
After Tommy's arrest, police searched his apartment and found live ammunition, fireworks, and a credit card skimmer. And when they searched his parents' summer home, they found and opened Tommy's safe, which included more live ammunition and gun accessories, a gun manual, a love letter to a former socialite girlfriend, and a throwing star, just like the ones used in his favorite ninja movies. A month after killing his father, Tommy pleaded not guilty to second-degree murder, two counts of criminal weapons possession, and possession of forgery devices. The judge denied bail, thankfully, and Tommy remained at Rikers Island, where he was offered the antipsychotic drug Risperdal, but refused it because he, quote, needed a clear head to concentrate on his defense. Tommy's trial was only 5 weeks long, but it took 4 years just to get started. This was because Tommy's defense team, paid for by his mother, was adamant about trying to get him declared unfit for trial. Their goal was to get Tommy treatment at a psychiatric facility while they prepared an insanity defense. We've been covering the insanity defense and all there is to know about it on my new series, Killer Psyche Daily. Go and listen to it. I think you'll find it very enlightening, especially in light of this story. The judge agreed to have Tommy evaluated, but the first two court-appointed psychiatrist reports were inconclusive. They said they were unable to decide if Tommy was fit or not. Partly this seemed to be because Tommy refused to discuss the case with them due to what he said were, quote, internal guidelines. So the judge requested a third competency evaluation. This time, the psychiatrist found Tommy fit, and the trial could finally start. During his competency hearing, Tommy did not show up, but instead requested the number for the president of Cablevision. He also said he believed he was radioactive and needed medical treatment. He also wanted to call the entire Iraqi consulate as a witness for the defense. During the trial, he was often disruptive in court. He objected to his attorney's own questions, addressed the court directly, and, at another point, addressed the jury directly. That may seem like, well, crazy behavior, but there are plenty of defendants who are not mentally ill who have done that. But he certainly wasn't helping his cause. Other times, Tommy would show up and then request to be taken back to Rikers. And when he was present and allowed to speak, he would refer to himself in the third person. In the end, the jury deliberated for 2 days before reaching their verdict, finding Thomas Gilbert Jr. guilty of murder in the second degree, along with 2 counts of criminal possession of a weapon. Ultimately, the detail that united the jury was Tommy's request for a Coke on the day of the murder. They believed that since Shelley never kept it in the house, this was evidence of premeditation and enough for them to decide on a conviction despite Tommy's mental illness. That does not surprise me. It is not uncommon for juries to find one thing in the defendant's history indicating lucidity and determine that because of that one moment, that they are not mentally ill. Sadly, they are wrong. Tommy was compelled to commit this crime because of his mental illness. Before sentencing, the judge gave Tommy a chance to speak. He requested a mistrial and a dismissal of all charges. He finished by stating, quote, defendant expresses remorse. His mother, Shelley, was distraught. She was hoping Tommy would get the minimum 15-year sentence, but instead, he got the maximum, 30 years to life. Thomas Gilbert Jr. is serving out his sentence at the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York. He will be eligible for parole in 2049. I've been to that prison. There is a 40-foot wall surrounding it. It is archaic, it is imposing, and is not a place for someone as mentally ill as Thomas Gilbert Jr. I will be surprised if he makes it to 2049. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Story research and additional writing by Anne Liu. Mix and sound design by Joshua Morales. Senior audio producer, Maxwell Carney. Head of audio, Tom Monahan. Renee Levesque is our production manager. Lindsay Whistler, Colin Modell, and Jada Williams are production assistants. Oscar Guido is the producer from Treefort Media. From Amazon Music and Wondery, the producer is Stephanie Joaquin. And the co-executive producer is Julie Burke. Lastly, our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort, and Marshall Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shay Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shay Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.